Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Vimer Deese. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast introduction. It's going to be actually short, which may seem surprising to some of you. But I wanted to give a little bit of an explanation to the speech that you're about to hear prior to actually getting into the episode. I had intended to shrink down this Robert F. Kennedy speech to about 10 minutes. But in listening to it all the way through, I was only able to shave off about 10 or 12 minutes of the original content, which left about 24 minutes of speech. I didn't want to get rid of it. Because, as I've said to many of you before, I am a big fan of old speeches. I think there was once upon a time, and I actually see this more with conservatives today than I do with progressives, and for the few who actually claim it, liberals. I see it with radicals, the few radicals that actually come out and say, yeah, I'm a radical. But there used to be a time when speeches were very direct. They were not conversations. Impersonal. There was an attempt by the person who was speaking to be persuasive and to tap into the person, whoever they were talking to, in a very charismatic way. The greater speech givers always tried to do this because they were molding something that was far greater than themselves. They wanted to mold the person's mind, thinking, and such, so that they could then go out and impact the world. As I said, conservatives do this a lot, even though they're not boisterous and vociferous when it comes to their speaking habits and arrangements. They are, though they work with an undercurrent of wanting to mold the person so they can go out and mold the world. Progressives and the few liberals that I've seen today don't actually, I guess, fall into this category, but most of the people who I hear, they don't have any true spiritual connection. And so, to realize that their judgment to give a speech has the grave impact of moving a person to want to mobilize towards shaping the world is the last thing on their mind. The problem with this is because they have no spiritual essence to what they're saying, soon, if you're just relying on the mind to charge a person and to keep a person focused, the mind isn't there for that. The mind is not there to energize the body. The spirit is there to energize the body. The spirit holds the content in which the rest of the body operates on. In other words, each individual person lives in a personal atmosphere, lives in an individual atmosphere, which is then fed by a collective atmosphere. We tend to call that a family, which is fed by another collective atmosphere. We tend to call that a community, and so on and so forth. If that person's collective atmosphere only goes on what the mind knows, and the mind is grounded in the lowest level of the planet, which is material. And that's what, when we talk about facts, cold hard facts, we're talking about material stuff. Cold hard facts, as one brother that I was listening to said, they change. So therefore, if you're going by facts, 20 years ago, these facts might have been true, but today they aren't. Or, because you can add other facts to them, it changes what they mean. That then creates a disability, should I say, within the personal atmosphere, because it's always constantly trying to change and move. when you're talking about spiritual truths, when you're talking about higher truths that get up into that spiritual realm, that hit that consciousness level, you're talking about something that doesn't change. Radicalism comes from that higher point, which is why so many people, so many conservatives will absolutely positively criticize radicalism, because it comes from that spiritual point. This is why they confuse it constantly and consistently, because radicalism is spiritual. And that spiritual point, when it hits you, when it infects you, and I don't mean infect as in a virus, because we often think of infection as just a virus. No, no, no. Something can infect you and not actually hurt you. A lot of the times when we eat things, technically, while we're ingesting those, but when they inoculate you against something, they're technically infecting you with whatever it is that they're giving you. So when it infects you, it really moves your body to now a new rhythm and a new beat. And that activates your soul. It activates your essence. And these are actually different parts of the being. It then activates your mind. It activates your heart. And it continues to mobilize you towards your root. And if you check out the root chakra, which we are accustomed to, is in the sternum. It's by the genitals. But there's a second root chakra, which is deeper. And then there's the earth chakra. To say nothing about the soul chakra or the universal chakra. But it initiates and initializes and it activates all of these. And it brings up your temple. So that now, when you literally think about change and choice for change, it literally inscribes it onto your surroundings. This is why they talk about being radicalized. This is why they talk about being radicalized, because this is a metaphysical concept. They know the power of true radicalism. I'm not talking fundamentalism, which is what most of these people who they're talking about being radicalized are. They're fundamentalists. They are fundamentalized. They're not radicalized. With radicalism, you can look up certain truisms which hold a reality 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, and those truisms will hold the same weight and value as they do today. The 1960s was a time of immense radicalism. And they had to stamp that down because of the spiritual essence of it. And it took a lot of work. They weren't able to really do it until they shifted the musical genre. The pulse beat that people were engaging in. And that happened in the mid-90s. Prior to that, they were always struggling against radicalism. The world that you see now is in part created because of the work that has been done to stamp out radicalism. And they'll tell you that. They constantly tell you, watch any news program from the last 40 years, they'll tell you that they wanted to stop radicalism. They wanted to stop radicalism. People like John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Che Guevara, Assata Shakur, this is why they're so high on her, the Black Panthers, Mumia, and many others. They feared these people because they deemed them to be radicals spreading radicalism. And they tell you this. They're brazen about this. The question is, why were they so fearful of radicalism? You can go back even further. Mother Jones, Eugene Debs. You know, there's many white people, and I'm sorry if I didn't mention any from the 60s and the 70s, but my major view and work has always been on the black radicals. Watch the documentary, All Power to the People, All Power to the People, All Power to the People, All Power to the People. Read the book, The Cointel Papers. There's another one that goes with that, by the way. But they are fearful of it because it's spiritual and it's greater than them. That's why they fear it. That's why they fear it. I even believe in some instances, in some ways, that's why they've attacked the spirit in religion. Not religion in general, but they have promoted atheism and the watering down of spiritualism in every community. Because with those things came a higher calling. They had to sever that higher calling. So I included this speech basically for spiritual purposes. I included it for spiritual purposes. This speech works on many levels. And I want you to realize, forgiving for the moment the historical relevance of what happened between when he gave it and today, because that's important too. But realizing that what he's saying, what he is talking about, is as true today as it was then. And that should tell you something about where this planet has gone wrong. I'll see you on the other side.
This is a day of affirmation, a celebration of liberty. We stand here in the name of freedom. At the heart of that Western freedom and democracy is the belief that the individual man, the child of God, is the touchstone of value, and all society, all groups and states exist for that person's benefit. Therefore, the enlargement of liberty for individual human beings must be the supreme goal and the abiding practice of any Western society. The first element of this individual liberty is the freedom of speech, the right to express and communicate ideas, to set oneself apart from the dumb beasts of field and forest, the right to recall governments to their duties and to their obligations. Above all, the right to affirm one's membership and allegiance to the body politic, to society, to the men with whom we share our land, our heritage, and our children's future. Hand in hand with freedom of speech goes the power to be heard, to share in the decisions of government which shape men's lives. Everything that makes man's life worthwhile, family, work, education, a place to rear one's children, and a place to rest one's head, all this depends on the decisions of government. All can be swept away by a government which does not heed the demands of its people, and I mean all of its people. Therefore, this essential humanity of man can be protected and preserved only where government must answer, not just to the wealthy, not just to those of a particular religion, not just to those of a particular race, but to all of the people. And even government, by the consent of the governed, as in our own Constitution, must be limited in its power to act against its people, so that there may be no interference with the right to worship, but also no interference with the security of the home. No arbitrary imposition of pains or penalties on an ordinary citizen by officials high or low. No restriction on the freedom of men to seek education or to seek work or opportunity of any kind, so that each man may become all that he is capable of becoming. These are the sacred rights of Western society. These were the essential differences between us and Nazi Germany, as they were between Athens and Persia. They are the essence of our differences with communism today. I am unalterably opposed to communism because it exalts the state over the individual and over the family, and because its system contains a lack of freedom of speech, of protest, of religion, and of the press, which is characteristic of a totalitarian regime. The way of opposition to communism, however, is not to imitate its dictatorship, but to enlarge individual human freedom. There are those in every land who would label as communist every threat to their privilege. But may I say to you, as I have seen on my travels in all sections of the world, reform is not communism. And the denial of freedom in whatever name only strengthens the very communism it claims to oppose. Many nations have set forth their own definitions and declarations of these principles. And there have often been wide and tragic gaps between promise and performance, ideal and reality. Yet the great ideals have constantly recalled us to our own duties. And with painful slowness, we in the United States have extended and enlarged the meaning and the practice of freedom to all of our people. For two centuries, my own country has struggled to overcome the self-imposed handicap of prejudice and discrimination based on nationality, on social class, or race. Discrimination profoundly repugnant to the theory and to the command of our Constitution. We have passed laws prohibiting discrimination in education, in employment, in housing. But these laws alone cannot overcome the heritage of centuries of broken families and stunted children and poverty and degradation and pain. So the road toward equality of freedom is not easy, and great cost and danger march alongside all of us. We are committed to peaceful and nonviolent change, and that is important to all to understand, though change is unsettling. Still, even in the turbulence of protest and struggle, is greater hope for the future, as men learn to claim and achieve for themselves the rights formerly petitioned from others. And most important of all of the panoply of government power has been committed to the goal of equality before the law, as we are now committing ourselves to the achievement of equal opportunity. In fact, we must recognize the full human equality of all of our people, before God, before the law, and in the councils of government. We must do this not because it is economically advantageous, although it is, not because the laws of God command it, although they do, not because people in other lands wish it so. We must do it for the single and fundamental reason that it is the right thing to do. We recognize that there are problems and obstacles before the fulfillment of these ideals in the United States, as we recognize that other nations in Latin America and in Asia and in Africa have their own political, economic, and social problems, their unique barriers to the elimination of injustices. In some, there is concern that change will submerge the rights of a minority, particularly where that minority is of a different race than that of the majority. We in the United States believe in the protection of minorities. We recognize the contributions that they can make and the leadership that they can provide. And we do not believe that any people, whether majority or minority, or individual human beings, are expendable in the cause of theory or our policy. We recognize also that justice between men and nations is imperfect, and that humanity sometimes progresses very slowly indeed. All do not develop in the same manner and at the same pace. Nations, like men, often march to the beat of different drummers, and the precise solutions of the United States can neither be dictated nor transplanted to others, and that is not our intention. What is important, however, is that all nations must march toward increasing freedom, toward justice for all, toward a society strong and flexible enough to meet the demands of all of its people, whatever their race, and the demands that the world of an immense and dizzying change that faces all. In a few hours, the plane that brought me to this country crossed over oceans and countries which have been a crucible of human history. In minutes, we traced migrations of men over thousands of years. Seconds, the briefest glimpse, and we passed battlefields on which millions of men once struggled and died. We could see no national boundaries, no vast gulfs or high walls dividing people from people, only nature and the works of man, homes and factories and farms, everywhere reflecting man's common effort to enrich his life. Everywhere new technology and communications brings men and nations closer together. The concerns of one inevitably become the concerns of all. And our new closeness is stripping away the false masks, the illusion of differences, which is the root of injustice and of hate and of war. Only earthbound man still clings to the dark and poisoning superstition that his world is bounded by the nearest hill. His universe ends at river shore. His common humanity is enclosed in the tight circle of those who share his town or his views and the color of his skin. It is your job, the task of young people in this world, to strip the last remnants of that ancient cruel belief from the civilization of man. Each nation has different obstacles and different goals, shaped by the vagaries of history and of experience. Yet as I talk to young people around the world, I am impressed not by the diversity, but by the closeness of their goals, their desires and their concerns and their hope for the future. There is discrimination in New York, the racial inequality of apartheid in South Africa, and serfdom in the mountains of Peru. People starve to death in the streets of India. A former prime minister is summarily executed in the Congo. Intellectuals go to jail in Russia, and thousands are slaughtered in Indonesia. Wealth is lavished on armaments everywhere in the world. These are different evils, but they are the common works of man. They reflect the imperfections of human justice, the inadequacy of human compassion, the defectiveness of our sensibility toward the sufferings of our fellows. They mark the limit of our ability to use knowledge for the well-being of our fellow human beings throughout the world. And therefore, they call upon common qualities of conscience and indignation, a shared determination to wipe away the unnecessary sufferings of our fellow human beings at home and around the world. It is these qualities which make of our youth today the only true international community. More than this, I think that we could agree on what kind of a world we would all want to build. It would be a world of independent nations moving toward international community, each of which protected and respected the basic human freedoms. It would be a world which demanded of each government that it accept its responsibility to ensure social justice. It would be a world of constantly accelerating economic progress, not material welfare as an end in of itself, but as a means to liberate the capacity of every human being to pursue his talents and to pursue his hopes. It would, in short, be a world that we would all be proud to have built. Just to the north of here are lands of challenge and of opportunity, rich in natural resources, land and minerals and people. Yet they are also lands confronted by the greatest odds, overwhelming ignorance, internal tensions and strife, and great obstacles of climate and geography. Many of these nations as colonies were oppressed and were exploited. Yet they have not estranged themselves from the broad traditions of the West. They are hoping and they are gambling their progress and their stability on the chance that we will meet our responsibility to them, to help them overcome their poverty. In the world we would like to build, South Africa could play an outstanding role and a role of leadership in that effort. This country is without question a preeminent repository of the wealth and the knowledge and the skill of this continent. Here are the greater part of Africa's research scientists and steel production, most of its reservoirs of coal and of electric power. Many South Africans have made major contributions to African technical development and world science. The names of some are known wherever men seek to eliminate the ravages of tropical disease and of pestilence. In your faculties and councils, here in this very audience, are hundreds and thousands of men and women who could transform the lives of millions for all time to come. But the help and the leadership of South Africa or of the United States cannot be accepted if we, within our own countries or in our relationships with others, deny individual integrity, human dignity, and the common humanity of man. If we would lead outside our own borders, if we would help those who need our assistance, if we would meet our responsibilities to mankind, we must first, all of us, demolish the borders which history has erected between men within our own nations, barriers of race and religion, social class and ignorance. Our answer is the world's hope. It is to rely on you. The cruelties and the obstacles of this swiftly changing planet will not yield to obsolete dogmas and outworn slogans. It cannot be moved by those who cling to a present which is already dying, who prefer the illusion of security to the excitement and danger which comes with even the most peaceful progress. This world demands the qualities of youth, not a time of life, but a state of mind, a temper of the will, a quality of the imagination, a predominance of courage over timidity, of the appetite for adventure over the life of ease. It is a revolutionary world that we all live in. And thus, as I have said in Latin America, and in Asia, and in Europe, and in my own country, the United States, it is the young people who must take the lead. Thus, you and your young compatriots everywhere have had thrust upon you a greater burden of responsibility than any generation that has ever lived. There is, said an Italian philosopher, nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. Yet this is the measure of the task of your generation, and the road is strewn with many dangers. First is the danger of futility, the belief there is nothing one man or one woman can do against the enormous array of the world's ills, against misery, against ignorance, or injustice and violence. Give me a place to stand, said Archimedes, and I will move the world. Few will have the greatness to bend history, but each of us can work to change a small portion of the events, and in the total, all of these acts will be written in the history of this generation. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. If Athens shall appear great to you, said Pericles, consider then that her glories were purchased by valiant men and by men who learned their duty. That is the source of all greatness in all societies, and it is the key to progress in our time. The second danger is that of expediency, of those who say that hopes and beliefs must bend before immediate necessities. Of course, if we must act effectively, we must deal with the world as it is. We must get things done. But if there was one thing that President Kennedy stood for, that touched the most profound feeling of young people around the world, it was the belief that idealism, high aspirations, and deep convictions are not incompatible with the most practical and efficient of programs, that there is no basic inconsistency between ideals and realistic possibilities, no separation between the deepest desires of heart and of mind, and the rational application of human effort to human problems. It is not realistic or hard-headed to solve problems and take an action unguided by ultimate moral aim and values, although we all know some who claim that it is so. In my judgment, it is thoughtless folly, for it ignores the realities of human faith and of passion and of belief, forces ultimately more powerful than all the calculations of our economists or of our generals. Of course, to adhere to standards, to idealism, to vision, in the face of immediate dangers, takes great courage and takes self-confidence. But we also know that only those who dare, who fail greatly, can ever achieve greatly. It is this new idealism, which is also, I believe, the common heritage of a generation which has learned that while efficiency can lead to the camps at Auschwitz or the streets of Budapest, only the ideals of humanity and love can climb the hills of the Acropolis. And a third danger is timidity. Few men are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of their society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. It is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change the world, which yields most painfully to change. Aristotle tells us, at the Olympic Games, it is not the finest or the strongest men who are crowned, but those who enter the lists. So too in the life of the honorable and the good, it is they who act rightly who win the prize. I believe that in this generation, those with the courage to enter the conflict will find themselves with companions in every corner of the world. For the fortunate amongst us, the fourth danger, my friends, is comfort. The temptation to follow the easy and familiar path of personal ambition and financial success so grandly spread before those who have the privilege of an education. But that is not the road history has marked out for us. There is a Chinese curse which says, may he live in interesting times. Like it or not, we live in interesting times. They are times of danger and uncertainty, but they are also the most creative of any time in the history of mankind. And everyone here will ultimately be judged, will ultimately judge himself on the effort he has contributed to building a new world society and the extent to which his ideals and goals have shaped that effort. So we part, I to my country and you to remain. We are, if a man of 40 can claim the privilege, fellow members of the world's largest younger generation. Each of us have our own work to do. I know at times you must feel very alone with your problems and with your difficulties. But I want to say how impressed I am with the what you stand for and for the effort that you are making. And I say this not just for myself, but men and women all over the world. And I hope you will often take heart from the knowledge that you are joined with your fellow young people in every land. They struggling with their problems and you with yours, but all joined in a common purpose. That like the young people of my own country, and of every country that I have visited. You are all, in many ways, more closely united to the brothers of your time than to the older generation in any of these nations. We're determined to build a better future. President Kennedy was speaking to the young people of America, but beyond them to young people everywhere, when he said, "The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it, and the glow from that fire can truly light the world." And he added, "With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own." I thank you.
Storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vladimir Deese. Welcome to this episode of the Class 4 Battlefield Podcast. How y'all doing? You know, as it usually happens after I post what one could call a controversial episode, the subsequent episode won't upload. So that's why you're getting this one and number 13 late. I do my best to tell the truth. I do my best to tell reality how it is appearing to me, not only at the moment that I'm speaking, but really how it's kind of formulated over the last X amount of years through now and maybe even into the future. And I do that not simply because I like to hear myself talk. I know sometimes it could seem like the reason why I'm doing this is simply because I like to hear myself talk. But that's not why I'm doing this. I am doing this because so much of the truth that we need to confront right now is being hidden from us by opinion makers, news makers, people who literally are paid to keep you confused. We are told constantly, and especially for anybody who is 18 years old and younger, maybe even a little bit older than that, because this wasn't told to me when I was in high school. That was 20 years ago. Graduated in the year 2000. We see in this generation that they are told that to hold any opinion is valid. that truth doesn't matter. Opinion is more valid than anything. You have a right to your opinion. I have a right to my opinion. No, you do not. This strikes a chord with people. Because I've said it to people. When they said to me, oh, well, I have a right to my opinion and you do, and you have a right to your opinion. And I said, no, that is not true. When your opinion is based on a lie or a untruth or a misinterpretation of a reality, and those things are going to negatively impact me or harm me, then you do not have a right to your own opinion. I told this to somebody talking to them out on the street, and they became agitated. They became a little enraged. And I said, look, you're angry, and I understand that. If I was in your position, I'd be angry too. Well, then how can you say that? And I go, let's look at this another way. Okay, I'm going to give you a real-to-life scenario where opinion can cause injury. And I'm going to use you as an example. Let's say you and I have differing opinions. I say, if you hold someone's hand over an open flame, it won't burn them. You say, if you hold someone's hand over an open flame, it'll burn them. You have your opinion, I have mine. I now say, well, that's fine. I'm glad you have your opinion, but I don't believe it. So then you tell me that you knew somebody who took their hand by mistake, they were cooking, and they put their hand wrong over a open flame and burned themselves. It was, you know, not that serious, but it was still a burn. And so that disproves my opinion. And I look at you and I say, I still don't believe that. That's crazy. I mean, you could be just telling a story. So then you go and you talk to doctors. And you say, if somebody puts their hand over an open flame, could you please send me pictures? And doctors say, sure, we'll do that. And they send you pictures of all of these people with various degrees of burn. And then they give it to you. And then you give it to me. So I can see that this is something that is true. And I go, well, you know, you could have paid those doctors. Come on. Seriously, you could have paid those doctors. So you give me the phone numbers. You say, call these doctors. Ask them if I gave them any money. So I call the doctors. And the doctors say, nope, they didn't give us a cent. This is a real thing that's happening. And I go, well, I still don't believe you. I still don't believe you. And so now you're frustrated. Because unbeknownst to me, you had a daughter who mistakenly put her hand over a flame and burned herself so severely that she had to have skin grafts. So now you're frustrated, and you're trying to get me to see that what you're talking about is valid. So I say to you, I go, okay, listen, here's the only way that I'm ever going to believe it. I want you to put your hand over an open flame and allow me to witness it being burned, and then I'll believe you. So you say to me, all right, fine, okay, but I'm only keeping it there for a few moments. Turn on a stove, you put your hand over it, singes it a bit, and pulls it back, and you're in agonizing pain. And I go, well, why did you take your hand away? And you go, it was burning. Why would you smell that? That's my skin. It was burning. And I go, see, I don't believe that's what really happened. I think you were utilizing some chemical to make your hand do that. I grab your hand and then put it right underneath, right atop the flame, And as it's burning, I'm saying, wow, you know, I really can't tell what's causing that burn. And you're in pain the whole time. And finally, you punch me and pull your hand back and go to seek medical help. Now, that sounds insane. I said this to the person on the street. I go, that sounds insane, doesn't it? And he goes, yeah, because nobody would do that. And I go, absolutely. People do that all the time when they're arguing. People take opinions that aren't actually based on anything, and then they refuse to see the reality due to some mental process that they themselves are creating as evidence is being presented to contradict and disprove the reality that they are trying to impose, which isn't real. It's an opinion, really, that they're trying to impose. It's not real, but they want it to be real. Oh, people don't go to those lengths. People do go to those lengths. We are facing, this is why I bring this up, ladies and gentlemen. People are trying to figure out Donald Trump. What is Donald Trump? I've listened to Louis Farrakhan, and Louis Farrakhan said something very interesting. And I know for white people out there, you want to turn this off because it's like, oh my God, Louis Farrakhan, the white hating, blah, blah, blah. Most of you never listen to any Louis Farrakhan, and yet what the media tells you about him is what you want to believe. Louis Farrakhan is not the person you think he is. Does he talk about evil white people? Absolutely. Yes, he did. So didn't Martin Luther King. But he said something. He said something that I think is very profound. I don't like it sometimes because it's like, man, this is a hell of a punishment. But he said, you know, why would God allow somebody like Donald Trump to become president? And he said unequivocally, yes. God would allow someone like Donald Trump to become president. Why? Because God cares about who is the president of the United States. Donald Trump represents that part of the American psyche that has always been detached from reality. And it is a part of the American psyche that reaches all the way from the top of society, what we call the higher classes, to the lower class. You have people that breed and infuse and inflict confusion for a living. Their mind is a massive straitjacket of confusion, because it kind of is, but a massive maze of confusion. That's all they do. That is all they do. And they use opinion as a cover for what they are actually breeding, which is confusion. So when we talk about truth, we have now gotten into the habit, and this is particularly true with this newer generation, of saying, well, that's your truth, this is my truth. Truth is universal. Now, one thing that is true, which must be acknowledged, is yes, a person can have an individual truth, but that truth must in and of itself contribute to the broader, wider, global, universal truth. And this is what we have been missing. That is part of the formula that we have not gotten. We have been told to talk about individual truth, but it's not the individual truth that matters so much. It is how does that individual truth fit into the whole. Now, there is actually a group of people, we call them middle class people, who are trained to actually try to, in some limited fashion, think in terms of partial truth and, or really what we could call micro and macro truth, where the micro parts are then put together to form a macro truth. But, because they are so necessary to the top echelons of this society to keep them safe, they are limited in how far that truth can go. So they never want to actually threaten the system. They don't want to threaten the system. We all have individual particular truths that if we can get to them and then we can get together with, forget about like-minded people. The like-minded people ain't the ones that we really need. We need individuals who are willing to take their truths and cobble it together with other truths to make a broader truth. And if we were able to do that, that is what cooperative networking is really about. Then you start to see the world in a different light. You start to break through that confusion. This is actually what the wealthy has been fighting against. This is what they've been fighting against, because a community whose central theme is communication in an organized fashion, in a social cultural fashion, in a generational fashion, which passes one truth from one generation to the next truth, is really built about, or around, should I say, the individual truth being cobbled together with other individual truths to form a greater truth. And then that truth, in that one particular area, being formed with another truth in another particular area. This is why you have things like sister cities and sister communities, because you're technically taking one truth from one city and binding it together with another truth from another city, and you're creating this arch of energy where both can feed from it. We are in a period where massive confusion is being imposed. Massive confusion is, yes, being imposed. And we don't even understand that, because we are so trapped in the concept of individual freedom of expression in opinion. Because we've taken freedom of expression to mean opinion, basically. That we have lost our capability, the inner compass mechanism of knowing truth. And then when we do hit some hard-hitting truth, like what Bernie Sanders talks about a lot of the times, you know, look, I may not like everything about the guy, but the guy does say a lot of things that need to be said. When we are introduced to a big truth that 100 years ago would have been seen as almost laughable because it was so minute in the scale of what was actually happening with capitalism. 100 years ago, they were talking about replacing capitalism because capitalism just did not work. What Bernie Sanders is essentially saying is, in order for capitalism to work, we just have to rough out the edges. Even though he is he's a supposed democratic socialist. When we hear something like that, we are so starved for inner truth and for collective truth, we pounce on that. We pounce on it, and we make that our inmost truth. Each one of us has needs. I'm shifting a little here. Each one of us has needs. We each have needs that are not being met by this society. And if we were to compile a list of 10 or 20 of these needs, and may I suggest, along with the 10 or 20 needs, you get a piece of paper and you write needs that are not being met by this society, and I want you to list them for you and your family. What would make your life better? I don't care if you think it's absolutely insane. Like, more time with my family. Well, what does more time with my family mean? How about 4 weeks with my family? And then, after you write that list down, you're going to take another sheet of paper. And you're going to say, write on it, what a perfect society would look like. And you're going to write down 10 or 20 characteristics of a perfect society. And what I would suggest is you start with looking at how a society would treat family. How it would treat family. And then how your particular job would treat you as a worker. And then how how the school would treat or educate your child. What should your child know? And write those things down. Then I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. If you'd be so kind. I don't ask you guys to do me many favors, but this is a big one. Write those things down and then type them down and send them to me. My email address, which is available on radioforall.net. If you don't have radioforall.net, if you don't have access to it, that's fine. I'll give it to you right now. All right, so to reach me. Get a piece of paper. Here we go. vphiames.oGAARWA@outlook.com. vphiames.oGAARWA@outlook.com. And I ask you to send them to me for one reason. One reason only. Community. What is your ideal society? That is something that I've been wondering for a long time. Do people really want the same things? I don't believe everybody wants specifically the same things, but I think they want a lot of the same things. So if you do me that favor, send them to me. It'd be much appreciated. It'd be much appreciated. We are in a time period, though, where confusion is being imposed on us dramatically, because we are not supposed to be able to think our way out of the problems, the issues that we have. Now, it's ironic, because there was, in the 1980s, and I'm just now really realizing this, in the 1980s, there was a major shift economically in this country. This country shifted dramatically. I mean, we all know the whole production value of this country. So the GDP went from being one of being based on production to one that was based on finance. But what I'm just now understanding, and I've kind of made reference to this in earlier episodes, is what that did to our society. Now, we've become accustomed to hearing people say, oh, well, the American shopper, the American consumer is going to go for the lowest price. They want the greatest bargain. I actually believe that is untrue. I believe it's always been untrue. I think we have been force-fed this notion, and we have come to accept it as reality. The quality of products that were being made when this country was about manufacturing, that meant if we were about manufacturing, that means we were about engineering. We were about producing people who can produce things that really worked well. Now, granted, I understand now that one of the reasons that we were so good at making things is we were able to attract people from all over the world because we had advanced production. At the time, we don't have that anymore. But with the shift from being a production-based society to a society that was built on finance, what you saw was the quality of the products being built dramatically decline. And I myself have witnessed this over the last 20 years of being in the employment realm, having to look for employment. I've seen what has occurred at many manufacturing and warehousing facilities, where it's more about the numbers than it is about the quality. And I know. We're all supposed to be worried about quality. But trust me when I tell you, and anyone who has worked in manufacturing knows this. What we are supposed to be about and what we are about are two different things. We are about quality to an extent. Now, this trickles down to the rest of society. This actually trickles down to the rest of society. When you think about living in a society where everything you buy, everything you get, has no actual worth to it. So you know if you buy this laptop is likely to stop working very well after 3 or 4 years. So you need to get another one. That makes you, that kind of hits you psychologically, doesn't it? Where you start wondering if there is something fundamentally wrong with your society where they can't make a good laptop that lasts more than 3 or 4 years. Now, people will say, oh, well, you know, if you're paying $200, $300, $400 for a laptop, then you should only expect it to work 3 or 4 years. However, if you're working and you're only bringing home $700 every 2 weeks, maybe $800. Now, mind you, I didn't say every week. Some of you will get confused on that because, you know, you think in terms of middle class living. I'm talking about not low class living, but still lower class, where you're taking home $800 every 2 weeks. And that's because you are skimping a little bit on how much you are putting towards your retirement or how much you're putting towards your medical expenses. So if you're taking home $800 every 2 weeks, meaning out of 80 hours, you're making $10 an hour with taxes taken out. $400 is not a small amount. Now, you might say, well, you know, you get 3 or 4 years out of it. I mean, that's like getting almost $100,000 worth out of $400. Again, though, that $400 is a real amount. If you're paying $600 every month for your rent, you're talking about paying nearly 1 month of rent for a laptop. It hits you psychologically when you continue to buy item after item that only lasts 3 or 4 years and doesn't particularly perform well after a couple years. It hits you psychologically. You start wondering if there is something fundamentally wrong with your society where you can't make an electronic device that lasts longer than that amount of time. Now, let's compare. Those of us who are over the age of 30, we remember something called tube TVs. Now, some of you who are younger than 30, you also remember tube TVs because your parents and people still have them. But do you remember how long those things used to last? Now, mind you, I said some of us still have them. That's because there are tube TVs that were built 30 or 40 years ago, some even longer than that, that are still in very, very good condition and still functioning and operating and working very well. In fact, one of the predominant reasons that the switch to digital was kind of forced onto everybody because many older people refused to get rid of the analog televisions because not only was the color brighter, better, sometimes not brighter, but better, but the amount of, I'm going to call it radiation, even though some people might not call it radiation, but the amount of radiation that the TV seemed to cast into the room, so it kind of almost pulled attention in, was significantly less. when you compare the longevity of electronics from 40 years ago, from 30 years ago, and you compare them with today, you are looking at a rapid shift in consumer goods, if we were going to call them consumer goods. This is not lost on the psyche. I mean, literally, the mind looks at what was once had and says, my generation, or the generation slightly before me, maybe the sub-generation slightly before me, we are not as good as our grandparents, or we are not as good as our uncles and aunts, because we can't build that. We can't make that. We can't design that. What is wrong with us? The psyche literally does this. Because contrary to what we are told, every generation is trying to improve for the coming generation. And they think of improvement, even if they don't know it. This is the idea of the personal truth being cobbled together. Even if they don't know that they're doing it, they look back to the previous generations and say, what have you done? What achievements have you gained and have you wrought for us? Thus setting a standard for us. What achievements have you gained and we must, or what achievements must we exceed, should I say, to make sure that this coming up future has a better starting spot than you and I? And every generation does this. Every generation does this. And there is something that does happen to the psyche when you can look back and you can say, man, look at what they built. Look at how they built it. Look at the sturdiness of what they built. And now look at what we're building. Why can't we build what they built? What is wrong with us? Now, we are told that these things don't matter. It's a lie. These things do matter. These things matter. Because we are, contrary to what we are told, we are not individuals having one experience for ourselves. We are individuals that are made individuals because we are in a group. The individual only references the inner workings of our being. It is like saying indivisible. That is the individual. It is indivisible. That is what the individual is. It is indivisible. But the individual is only one if there are others. The individual is only one if there are others. So we can't see these truths because we are looking for monumental truth by only looking at ourselves. And that ain't never going to work. That will never work. That'll never work. Now, granted, sometimes you got to go inside personally to get get that truth so you can contribute it to the broader society. But it ain't going to work if you stay inside, if you stay by yourself. You got to grow externally also. And this is the frightening part, because history has taught the European culture that growing externally in a manner that is not sanctioned by official channels can be dangerous. We are not taught to look at history as something that impacts the not only present but the future. History has taught Europeans, particularly Europeans in this country, who call themselves American, You ain't American. You're Europeans. You're cutting yourself off from a lineage that can do a lot to inform you on how to deal with what's getting ready to come down. Europeans have been taught that if they act in the benefit of their own selves, particularly their communities, without having the justification to do so from a higher authority, that there is going to be hell to pay. Well, family, ladies and gentlemen, there's going to be hell to pay anyway. These people are setting you up for failure. This is why they are imposing so much confusion. Because they don't want you able to think your way through the coming catastrophes that they themselves are going to be the product of, or not the product of, the creators of. And what comes out of the other side is going to be massively important. And they know that. We are a confused society because we are being abused into confusion every single day by the things that we are taking in order to rapidly shift our minds into a state of denial. Constantly, we are in a state of denial. Donald Trump was literally put there to warn us about this denial. He was put there to make us see that if we, as communities, don't start to band together, to start to actually talk about the reality of climate change, global warming, and the catastrophe that is awaiting us if we don't do anything, if we don't heed the mother's cry, if we as communities don't get together and say, okay, we've done some wrong things to people in this community, to black people, to a lot of non-black people, and we are going to get this thing right, we are going to make it right, so we can all have peace together. If we don't get together and say, how can we take care of our communities after the dollar becomes junk? Oh yeah, this is something that none of us are paying attention to. We don't even understand how much of a real threat that is. That will happen in the next 10 years. The United States dollar will become junk. And at that time, as has been said in many interviews and pieces that are floating around the web, once when the United States dollar is dropped as a reserve currency, you will see hyperinflation. You will not be able to get a loaf of bread for less than $100, maybe. If we're lucky, maybe 50. This has happened throughout the world. We have to be prepared for that. If we are not willing to sit down and say, how are we going to feed ourselves? How are we going to clothe ourselves? How are we going to bring in fresh water when these corporations suddenly have the ability, as many of them are setting themselves up to do, to dictate a price which is so high that few of us will actually be able to pay it? What are we going to be willing to do to keep them from costing our families, our loved ones, our communities, their lives? We are starving ourselves and not even realizing it. Because we are looking at what is happening presently and saying, well, it's not the future, so we don't really have to worry about it. But you have to worry about these things. Because they are coming. And you think that I'm being an alarmist. Every day I am hearing more and more financial analysts who are looking at the data. They are saying there's going to be a severe crash coming. There's going to be a financial meltdown that's worse than 2008. And these are people who didn't get it right in 2008, saying all of the indicators are similar to what happened in 2008. These are all pointing towards a major catastrophe. And the legislation And this is something that Chris Hedges constantly talks about. The legislation, if you look at the legislative record of the Congress, they are doing things suggesting that they are preparing for a time period when there's going to be massive social unrest. They are preparing because they know if there is a meltdown like 2008, it's going to be worse, and there's going to possibly be panic because it's going to probably come during a time period when there is going to be international upheaval at the same time, and that's going to send the United States dollar into a panic, into a free fall, should I say. Now, many people don't realize this, and I realized it's so difficult, I can't find this anywhere. In 2008, I was listening to, I don't know if it was NPR or what, but I was listening to a radio station I never listened to, because I was listening to coverage that had to do with the presidential election. And they cut away to a news break, and this was right after the financial crash had happened. And they were talking about Detroit. I think it was Detroit, if memory serves me correctly. And they said that there were riot police, I'm trying to remember the exact wording, but they said that there were riot police, or that there was I don't think they said there was National Guard, but there were riot police stationed at every corner, because there was there began to be a run on specific stores, and they had to stop people from going to these stores because the run would have made it impossible for everybody in at least that community to get their needs met. Now, I heard about this story once, and it disappeared. It disappeared. Heard nothing more about it. If a financial meltdown was to occur and the United States dollar was to hit an inflation pattern, and suddenly people had to pay $20 for gas, for a gallon of gas, $30 for a loaf of bread, what kind of panic do you think that would cause? And what kind of response do you think this society would have to that panic? We are in a time of mass confusion. We aren't even thinking about that. We aren't thinking about the health and well-being of our community. Granted, look, I know, we're tired. We work. I get that. But what these people are planning to keep you in confusion and to keep you from acting in a manner that might threaten them, it makes what was done to the people trying to get into this country from Mexico with the tear gas, it makes it look like child's play. If we don't take the responsibility of caring for our communities right now and preparing for the tragedies that will come, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. We will be, trust me when I tell you that. I want to thank you all for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please reach out to me. I love talking to y'all. When you know I hope you've seen it before. Everything is good in your life. And I hope we will see each other again next week. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own.
or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.